Testing. Oh, hey, it works. Hello, everybody. Good morning. Woohoo! Hey, thank you all for rallying after rallying last night, no doubt. Welcome to Developing Cloud-Hosted Apps with MVC5. My name is Bob German, and I work for Blue Metal Architects, and really enjoy this technology. I hope you do too. I hope you get something out of this. Just a little expectation setting. This is a 400-level session. We will spend a lot of time in Visual Studio looking at code and things like that. So somebody's happy about that. I will also throw out the expectation that I have found that as I've talked to people about this, that the SharePoint community, most folks are not usually experienced with MVC and Entity Framework. So I'm not going to assume that you know those things. Hopefully that's a good thing, but if you're an MVC expert and you don't want the review part, then I won't be offended if you switch into another session. So this is some very cool technology, though, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. So looking at sort of the way things are today out there in the SharePoint world, most development today is still done in these full trust sort of farm solutions. And there's some kind of issues with this, right? Most of the code can affect the entire system or bring down SharePoint. It can bypass security. And I found that more and more SharePoint administrators, having been burnt by a missing dispose of an SP site object or one too many run with elevated privileges, are starting to become pretty hesitant to install these things. So much so that the cloud folks, the Office 365 folks, simply say, no, you can't do it. So we need another way to develop our apps. And so the app model obviously addresses this. Another issue today is that developers really need a dedicated SharePoint server in order to do any work. And you can always tell the SharePoint developers because they have the oversized backpacks and they're kind of hunched over and probably headed for the chiropractor, right? So one of the nice things about this is we're developing outside of SharePoint. So all you need is a machine that will support Visual Studio. And then your SharePoint is in the cloud in this case. Could be on-prem. Everything I'm showing today mostly will work on-prem, and with just a couple little settings will work on-prem. So I'll point that out. But anyway, you can definitely lighten your load. Developers now need much simpler hardware to the point where, just to sort of make a point, I actually started developing on my little Dell tablet. So this little 8-inch tablet more than meets the minimum requirements for Visual Studio 2013. And so just to sort of celebrate the unshackling of developers everywhere from these big laptops, we're going to give away one of these Dell Venue 8 Pro tablets today. And so at the end of the session, thank you. My colleague Sadie Van Buren, you may know her from the SharePoint maturity model, which she created. And my other colleague, which one? Julie is going to get, you may know her from the demo yesterday that she built actually for my talk yesterday. See, she can't escape. Sorry, Julie. Anyway, they're going to pass among you and gather up for the drawing later. So that'll be towards the end. So by the way, the code today is either going to be written in front of you so you could watch the recording, or it is downloadable. So don't feel like you have to write every little thing down. When we get into the code, you can literally download the code, win the tablet, and build everything with what you're getting here at the talk. So another thing about the existing model is that we're kind of stuck in the past. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. But first, I want to just sort of remind everybody, if you haven't seen the app model by now, I'll just really quickly mention that when you install your application, your SharePoint app, it goes into something called the host web. So that's a SharePoint site that when you're developing, you need a developer site to do that. But when you deploy it, you can use all different kinds of sites, of course. And then that app runs outside of SharePoint in the cloud in this case. Again, on-prem, you could host this yourself, or in Windows Azure, if you're on Office 365, you can use a so-called auto-hosted app. And Office 365, every Office 365 subscription includes an Azure, a little mini Azure subscription, so you can run these auto-hosted apps. So that's what I'll show today. And then once they're going, the apps can surface themselves in the SharePoint user interface. And I'll show how this works. There's a client web part that you can use to insert your app onto the page. And there's also something called the Chrome control, so that if you write your app to run full page, it can actually bring the branding experience from SharePoint into your app. And I'll show you how that works. And of course, your app needs to be able to access SharePoint content. And so it does that with either the client object model or the RESTful web services calls and something called OAuth. So we'll be talking about all of that today. Now, you might notice all the gray in my beard. When I first started with the web, we were over towards the left of this slide. In the very beginning days, web servers just served up static files, and then somebody figured out that they could insert some code in the middle to do something more dynamic. But it was really primitive back in the CGI days. And then ASP and ASP.NET had a page model where you could put some code on the page and intersperse it with your HTML, and that's the way SharePoint 2001 worked. Around about 2002, they came out with this thing called web forms. And that's the way SharePoint works today, by and large, is based on this web forms technology. And really, the way it was designed because in those times, most of the developers out there were building in like Visual Basic, or they were writing other kind of forms, drag and drop onto a desktop form kind of applications. These applications were stateful in nature, so they knew exactly what was going on at any given time. And WebForms tries to simulate that in a website. And so it gets really complicated because web servers are fundamentally stateless. The way you're supposed to design your code is that a request comes in and you fulfill the request and then you forget everything that you knew. You might store some stuff in a database, but you shouldn't be really keeping a lot of context in the server. And WebForms tries to get around this with this thing called ViewState, and it gets really messy really fast. So while SharePoint is kind of on that model, and I have no idea if they'll ever, you know, when they'll shift off of it because there's so many millions of lines of code that are wedded to that model in SharePoint, the app model allows us to run outside of SharePoint so we can get on board with MVC, which has become much more popular these days among general web developers. It is stateless. There's a number of advantages to it. This is my sort of little consumer reports view of the different models. You have more control over your HTML, definitely more than web forms, where you had controls that would sort of put out whatever markup they wanted to. A cool thing is that in the old two models, your URL was actually a path into the file system on the web server. And that made sense when you had a bunch of static files in that path, but it really doesn't make any sense in the world of dynamic applications running in a web server. So with MVC, you can actually use the URLs any way you want. You can actually kind of compose the way the URLs work, and I'll show you that. It's very cool. Drag and drop development, well, WebForms was designed for that, so we're not going to beat that. But very high degree of code reuse. And what I think is the biggest advantage of MVC is the ease of testing. So it is really hard to test a web forms application. You have to simulate a web browser and kind of go after it. And everything sent, the code tends to sort of all lump into one piece. You can design around that. But MVC was designed from the ground up for testability. So you can write unit tests and integration tests. And towards the end of the talk, I'll show you how to do that. And it's amazing. You can automatically test, like every time you hit the build button, the vast majority of your code in your MVC application, which can really improve your quality. So huge advantage there. And the other cool thing about MVC is that the components are replaceable. So virtually every part of MVC, you can, if you don't like the way they did it, you can write your own and plug it in. So all the different components are replaceable by you. So MVC itself stands for Model View Controller. So this diagram sort of shows a high level of how it works. And so you can see the model, the view, and the controller. And also, I included this thing called a route handler. So our sort of faceless but friendly user up here is coming down. And you can see that the URL doesn't necessarily relate to the file system. Now it relates to the context of the website. And so she types in that URL, and it comes down to the route handler. And the route handler is something that you can configure. And it can actually will parse through that URL and decide what to do. Based on that, it will go to the controller. The route handler will determine which controller to run. The controller is just an object in .NET, and that object has action methods. So each different possible URL that you would bring in, you can have different action methods that get called, and those methods then do something. They typically will talk to some data, that's the model. And then based on that data, they will pass some of that data off to the view. And the view is the only part that's a little bit hard to test. That does the final rendering into HTML. So you'll kind of see how all that works as we go into the demo. Filters are there too, we'll talk about them, but you can decorate your action methods with these little filters to affect the way that they work. And that's also a very powerful concept that I wanted to call out. So views are actually, I mentioned everything is replaceable in MVC. And so it's kind of cool that you can have these things called view engines. When MVC first came out, we had an ASP.NET view engine, and the syntax looked a lot like the web forms that you're probably familiar with. But Razor is now the current hip way to do it, and so my demos, it's the default now. It's simpler and more concise than the web form syntax. And then there are a number of third-party view engines that you can get, and so I've listed a couple of popular ones up there. The data has to get onto the view somehow. So your code in the controller is going to decide what to show and then allow the view to do the final rendering. When it decides what to show, there's two ways that it can pass data into the view. One is dynamically. So there's this thing called a view bag, which is really a property bag, bunch of little name value pairs. And so you can do that, but it's sort of loosely coupled. I think the best practice is to use a view model, which is strongly typed. So what you do there is you actually have a class called a view model that is designed to exactly have the data that your view needs. And then your view doesn't have any code in it. It just does data binding to the view model. So this, again, gets back to that whole testability idea, because you can write a test that looks at the view model. Instead of passing it to the view for rendering, it goes to your test, and your test makes sure that all the right data is in all the right places. And all that you're leaving out for the end is the rendering into HTML. The other topic I want to, before we dig into demos, that I want to just sort of touch on is Entity Framework. Entity Framework, if you haven't checked it out, is an object relational mapping framework. And basically what that means is that you don't have to write much of a data access layer. It's going to do all the heavy lifting for you. There are three ways you can do this. One is code first, where you literally start with some object classes, some very simple classes, and Entity Framework will generate the data access based on that and will also optionally generate the entire database for you. You can use it very effectively against an existing database, and this is kind of my favorite method, so that's what I'll be showing today. Database first is another option. So if you have an existing database, Entity Framework will reverse engineer your database, build the data access layer, and build C# or Visual Basic objects that represent the entities in there so that you can access those from your code. And then if you're kind of more artistically inclined and you want to start with a model, you want to start with a graphical model of what your entities look like, you can use model first, and it'll generate the database and the code for you. So another very cool technology that we'll be covering today. So I want to start with a demo that is kind of a from scratch demo. I take this sort of from my own experience of going to sessions like this. If I'm trying to learn something new, I really prefer to, if somebody comes up with a fully baked menu, it's kind of like watching one of these cooking shows on TV and this gorgeous banquet comes out and you're like, I could never do that. Well, you can do this, and so I'm actually going to start with a completely blank slate here in this initial demo and see what we can get going without anything except for Visual Studio being installed. So I'm going to go ahead. This is Visual Studio Ultimate. You don't need Ultimate to do this, but you do need 2013. This has been made significantly easier in Visual Studio 2013. So I'll go ahead and make a new project. And what I want to do is come down here into my templates and look for the apps underneath of SharePoint. And we'll pick an app for SharePoint. And I'll try not to mess up the mouse here. So let's imagine that we are here in Vegas and we're running a radio station or a DJ company and we have thousands and thousands of songs to keep track of. And so we're going to go ahead and store those inside of SQL Server rather than inside of SharePoint so that we have a chance to see how Entity Framework works. So I'm going to go ahead and create the project, and the first thing it wants to know is where is my SharePoint site that I want to use for debugging. And I've given it the location of my SharePoint developer site up in Office 365. You can sign up for one of these for free and on a trial basis and play around with it if you wish. And I'm also going to specify auto-hosted, which means that my code, my MVC code is going to be, the whole site will be packaged up at the end and deployed out to Windows Azure. If you wanted to do this on premises or if you wanted to host this yourself for some reason, elsewhere you would click provider hosted and it would be the same, almost the same experience. There are some differences in security and I would point you to Ted Pattison's talk on OAuth and server-to-server authentication for details on those more subtle differences. The other thing I get to choose is whether or not I want web forms or MVC. And if I chose web forms, you would probably all leave, so I think I'll choose MVC here. And it'll go ahead and create this library for me. So it's actually creating two projects. One is a song, one is a SharePoint app solution, and the other is the MVC application, which has the name Song Library Web. And so it's creating all these things, and I'm going to start by just clicking the Go button and letting this build and deploy while I'm explaining it. It's going to want to know my Office 365 login so it can deploy it for me. And you'll see here, here's the two projects. There's not a whole lot in the SharePoint one. What's interesting is this thing called the app manifest. This is where I would specify any permissions that I wanted my app to have. So you can have very granular permissions that you allow the app to access different things in SharePoint. And there's a whole bunch of other settings here, but for this demo, I don't really need to mess with those. And I have to give you a little caveat that in practicing this repeatedly, I did run into some kind of an issue where it loses my identity, and if that happens, I'll just switch over to the videos that I prepared for in case of an internet problem, because we don't really have too much time. But so far, so good here. Takes a minute to get this thing deployed. So let's see, what else can I talk about? The controller is here. So this is the home controller that it has generated for my project. I believe it's still working on deploying this. Also, if the internet is excessively slow, I may switch over to the videos. There was one step in particular of downloading Entity Framework where I found that when I was in the hotel, it took a really long time. So let's give this a chance, though. Ah, there it is. Thank you. It was working all along, and it was hidden. Thank you to the person in the audience. So it came up probably long, much musing ago, and here it is. It wants to know if I trust this app, and I'll say yes. If I had asked for any special permissions, that would have shown up here too. And now with any luck, this will come up, and it will say hello to me. It does. All right, so it's working. This was where I had the problem. So it's not doing a heck of a lot, but I didn't do very much. This is just a blank template. But notice that it says welcome to me, and it knows my identity. So that's kind of interesting. It's actually using SharePoint. It's using Office 365 to figure out who I am and to say welcome to me. So let's quickly take a look at that. If we look at the controller, this is my home controller, which is the default controller. So when I visited that that app, it actually just didn't have anything on the URL except for the server name. And the default controller is the home controller. The default action method is index. And notice that here's one of those filters I mentioned. This is the SharePoint context filter, which is going to ensure that my SharePoint context that I need to use the SharePoint API is available inside of this action method. Then I can come in here and grab the SharePoint context object, and I can load the user's name, the user title, execute the query, and then pass that into the view in the view bag, and it will render the little welcome message. So let's do something a little bit more fun than that and bring Entity Framework into it. So I'm going to go to the Library Package Manager and bring up NuGet, and There we go. And let's go ahead and look online. And I'm going to look for Entity Framework. So Entity Framework, for a while there, was part of Visual Studio, but they've actually, it's interesting. Maybe they changed it last night. We'll see. Oh, here we go. Okay. Entity Framework was originally packaged with Visual Studio, but they've actually decoupled it now so that they can version it independently of Visual Studio. And now you'll see it's asking if I want to add Entity Framework into my projects. And I don't really need it in that little SharePoint project, so I'll just put it into the MVC project. I'll accept the license. And it will go ahead and install Entity Framework for me. So that's good. So the next thing I want to do is go ahead and define my data model. So come down here to the Models folder. And I'm going to add a new class, just a simple little class. And we'll call it Song, because that's what we're going to keep track of. And I'll come in here and add a little snippet. Oop, wrong snippet. And so here's my song class. So can everybody see the code in the back and everything? Just yell out if you can. I can make it bigger. So it's really simple stuff, right? It's just a little class. No special decorations, no special inheritance. It's just defining a song. It's going to have an ID, a title, an artist, and one of several genres that I've defined via an enum. Keep in mind that if I had something more complex, I could actually easily do that. I could have a very fancy set of related entities, and it would actually handle all of that. The next thing I need to do is to actually build my data access layer so that I can access that. So I'll come in here and add, I'm not going to add a class. Let me put this in a little folder. And so we'll call that data access. And then the folder, we'll put in a class. And we'll call this song DB context. And what this one's going to do, this is a little bit more going on here. This is going to tell an Entity Framework about my model classes. And I have to do a little special magic here with the connection string. And that's for SQL Azure. I'll explain that when we get to it. But Azure will be provisioning a SQL Azure database for us. And so we need to store the connection string in the spot where Azure is going to will kind of overwrite my connection string with its connection string so that when we go to run inside of Azure, it can connect to the database out there. So that's why I had to add this little extra constructor here. So the next thing I really want to do is add that connection string. So I'll come down here to my web.config and go ahead and add this. So it has to have this special name and called SQL Azure Connection String. It's just I have it pointing to the little version of SQL on my development box, and I'm calling it MusicDB. I could really do anything as long as it's called SQL Azure Connection String, because again, it's going to overwrite this in the web.config when it deploys to Azure and have it point to a new database in Azure, in the Azure side. So the other thing I need to do is I think I'm finally ready, actually, to let the code generation happen. So this is pretty cool. By just doing this much, and we have to do a build to make sure that this works, I can go to my controllers and click Add and add a new scaffolded item. And this is where it's going to do all the heavy lifting for me. Basically, it's going to generate an MVC5 controller, so it's going to make a new second controller for me. And it's going to generate all the views to do CRUD operations against my Entity Framework model. So in order for that to work, I need to tell it a little bit about what I'm doing. I need to tell it what class is my model. So that's going to be the song class. And I'm going to have to tell it what the data context class is. And then finally, this last thing is a layout page. Layout pages are a lot like master pages were in web forms. So I'm just going to use the same layout page that I got with the template. And then in the second demo, I'll have a little bit more advanced one that shows how to bring the SharePoint branding in into my solution. So now I'm going to go have a drink down by the pool, and you know, it's just going to do all my work for me. At the end of the day, I'll tell my boss that I've worked really hard to build out this entire demo. And you can see here it's built out the controller for me. I've got all the CRUD operations, so I've got an index of my songs. I've got the details of a song. I can create them. Notice that it's actually going to decorate these also with things like a post. So this is when I create something, it's going to post back after I fill in a little form. And so that'll call this action method instead of the regular get one. And so it's basically done a lot of work for me. The only thing I really need to do here at this point is to pass in the connection string. There's a kind of a default location for these that we can't use because of that Azure trick. So I'll go ahead and pass in, just read in that web.config value and pass that in as a connection string. And the final thing I need to do is I've actually got a whole bunch of pages now to do this, but I have no way of navigating to them. So I'm going to come down here to my views, and notice, by the way, that it's created views for create, delete, details, all this stuff. It's created those views for me. What I need to do is go to that shared location, that equivalent of the master page, and I just need to add another link here. This is how you link to, I could just put a URL here, but by using this action link method, it actually will look at my routing rules and send this to the right place. So this is our first sort of experience looking at Razor. The really short of it is that it's HTML, and then you can break into C# or Visual Basic by using the @ notation. And so it's literally calling this little method called HTML.actionLink. And the only thing I'm going to change here is I'm going to change the link, of course. So, and this is in the song controller. And if the demo is ready now, I think I should be able to go ahead and run this. So this will deploy out there. And what you might notice is when it starts running, first of all, it should not need to prompt me again to trust it, because I didn't change anything on the SharePoint side. So it's pretty smart about that. It doesn't have to deploy anything to the SharePoint site. It will skip that deployment step to make your experience faster. Also notice that if you were paying attention to the URL, I was briefly on the SharePoint site, but now I'm on localhost. And the reason I'm on localhost is so that I can debug my solution. When I finally deploy it, this will be an Azure URL. But right now, it's running inside of IIS Express locally. Another thing you might notice about my URL is that it has all this goo on the end, including the host web URL, so SP host URL. This is really important. This is how that SharePoint context works. If it doesn't have that, it can't actually get the SharePoint context to talk back to the SharePoint site. So we'll see how we have to kind of maintain that. The reason that this songs link, if I click on songs, it will also have that URL on it. And the reason that it has that is because, I forgot to clear out the database, so I guess we've already got a couple of songs in there from when I was practicing. The reason that that this SP host URL got passed in again is because the Visual Studio template for SharePoint actually put a little piece of JavaScript in that shared layout. And what it does is it'll find every link on the page and make sure that it has the host URL in there at runtime. So let's see. Let me come in here and add another song. So I don't know any more. Anybody else got other Elvis songs here? I'm feeling Elvis-y because this is Blue Suede Shoes. All right, and so there's my Blue Suede Shoes. So it's working. It's storing the stuff in the database. Here's the trick. If I go back home, not good. I go back home and I get an error. Why? Because somehow I lost the little URL that's there. So it lost the SharePoint context. So we don't want that to happen. So let's go fix that. What's happening here is if I go into my controller, let's look at that create again. The create is the pattern sort of for posting information back, would be a post back in web forms, right? Is actually going to have different action methods, one for the get Now, you might wonder, I'm just returning view. By returning view, there's a convention that says that the action method will look for a view with the same name. So I could override that if I wanted to, but by default, it's going to return the create view, which had that little form I filled in to create the new song. When I post back, it's smart enough to call the other method with the HTTP post and to bind this information in, which is great. The problem is, at the end, it redirects you back to the index, back to the main index of songs. And when it does that, the MVC scaffolding didn't know about the SharePoint stuff, and so it didn't put that URL on there, that host URL, and so it lost the context for me. So let me fix that. So the way, here's the fix. I just have to pass in the SharePoint host URL, which I can get directly from the SharePoint context. And so if I go ahead and do that on each one of these, let me save that. So obviously there's three of these, right? It's the CRUD operations. There's one on the edit, one on the delete, one on the create. And now if I run this, I will be able to create a song and it should remember who I am. So let's do this one more time. So if Jonathan were here, Jonathan is a beagle kind of guy, one of my coworkers, so he'd probably want hound dog. And so I'll just to do another create, and then if I go home, hey, it remembers who I am. So good stuff. So the other thing I'm going to want to do here is actually deploy this up into Azure. So far I'm running on a local database. I can see that actually if I come in here and connect to it. You'll see that I can come in here and actually view these songs. And so there was no trickery here. This is just a SQL database. There's everything I had entered. The problem is that in production, I don't want to use my little laptop local database. So I have to tell I have to tell Office 365 that my solution includes a database. If I just deployed to Azure now, my solution would not work because the solution doesn't have a database in it. Office 365 wouldn't provision a database, therefore it wouldn't override the connection string, and it would try to connect, and there wouldn't be any database there. So the solution to this is really simple. All I have to do is create an empty database and include it in my project. So I'm going to go ahead and make an empty project, come down here to SQL Server, and I could almost call it anything I want it. I'll call it SongDB, and it'll go ahead and create that. Now, Entity Framework built the database for me, so I don't need to worry about the creating the schema and everything like that. However, you can get it to script that stuff for you, so that's always an option. So now I've got my database project. I just have to come here to my song library, and let's see, I need to fit this on the screen. Somehow I need to get into the properties of this thing. Not those properties, the other properties. F4, thank you. There we go, thank you. You guys are the best. So I need to go ahead and set my SQL database to that database project, and it kindly offers to update that to a Windows Azure SQL database. So now I can go ahead and deploy the solution, and Office 365 will provision a database. It'll make sure the app is there. It'll provision the database. It'll deploy my MVC file to the package, the whole thing up, deploy it to Azure, substitute the connection string with a pointer to the new database, and the whole thing will be running in SQL Azure, and then I can take my laptop away and just let it run. So the database thing is kind of cool. You can actually get it to script the database for you. And you can also turn on a versioning feature in Entity Framework. This is an awesome feature that I won't have time to dig into, but I want you to know that it exists. You can have it remember versions of the database, and it will generate scripts that have the changes since the last schema. So it will automatically upgrade the database for you when you deploy the new version. So, and you can run those scripts manually if you have a DBA or something who wants to be involved in that. So notice now my URL is some funny GUID thing from Azure. And if I come in here, I should see an empty database, and I can create a new one, and we'll do a jazzy one this time. And there it is. It works. So that's it. Thank you. So hopefully that was a valuable use of the time. We're going to get into a more fully baked example now, but I really wanted to sort of demystify that for everybody by showing it from scratch. So let's see here. I'll worry about teeing up the next one later. All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is accessing SharePoint. So there's all kinds of things that you can do with the client object model and the RESTful calls. And so you're going to access SharePoint from, since you're running outside of SharePoint, you're going to have to use these client APIs. I personally like the client object model, particularly for managed code. It's easier than trying to construct the little RESTful calls in your code. It also batches the requests, which is rather nice, so you can do several requests with one round trip to the server. This list is out of date as of Monday's keynote. So they've added even more cool stuff to this list. But you can see all the different areas that you can get at using the client object model. So it's becoming almost as rich as the server object model, and they close the gap more on that every day. The other thing, again, I'll put in a plug for Ted's talk, Ted Pattison's talk that goes deeper into this. But the other thing to be aware of is OAuth. OAuth does not stand for authentication, it stands for authorization. And it is a very well-established standard out there in the world. It was actually invented so that you could handle scenarios like a Facebook app that wants access to your Twitter or a Twitter that wants access to something else. You don't have to give your password or your user credentials to that third-party service. You can authorize that third-party service to reach in on your behalf and do something. So in this case, SharePoint is authorizing the MVC app to reach in on the user's behalf and or on the app's behalf, which is really important because maybe the user doesn't have permission to do something, but the app does. So this is so much nicer than run with elevated privileges, which is kind of dangerous. In this case, you really have the ability to say very, very specifically what can this app do or can this app not do using OAuth. And again, the MVC app will never actually see the user's credentials, which is quite a bit more secure. That stuff all stays in SharePoint. Also want to very quickly mention these filters. We saw a couple of examples already. What's nice is you can put a filter on a class, and it'll affect the entire class, all the action methods in the controller. Or you can put it on individual methods. And there are a number of different kinds of filters. Authentication is kind of obvious. Authorization can limit access to an action method. So my more advanced example actually has one of these where if you can trim on the user interface and say you're not allowed to do certain things, but if you were to type in a certain URL, we still don't want you to be able to do it. So you can mark the method with authorization rules. Actions run before and after the action method, and the result of the action method is like normally a view or a redirect or something. We saw a couple of those already. The result filter will run before and after the result. And finally, the exception one is nice. That's sort of your way of declaring how you're going to handle exceptions inside of your action method or your controller class. So just trying to kind of orient you to some of this stuff as you dig into this. So this next demo is a bit more fleshed out. And I'm going to use it as a backdrop to show you some examples of the client object model, the Chrome control, which brings the SharePoint branding into the solution, into the MVC app, and also the client web part. So this one starts as all app demos seem to start with, do you trust it? And in this case, I needed to give it a little bit more permission. I'm going to allow it to read items in the site so that it can actually pull some data down from SharePoint. And so I had to make sure that that one was set. And then we'll trust it. And my little app is, I call it Photo Story. Basically, the concept is that if you had, there's lots of ways of viewing slides in a picture library or viewing a picture library as a slideshow. But what if my pictures are scattered out in many picture libraries and I just want to hand pick a few pictures to make my slideshow and tell a little story? So this gave me an opportunity to use Entity Framework to store the URLs of all the pictures and to also access SharePoint to traverse the different picture libraries that I'm selecting from. So I'm going to go ahead and create a new one of these. And of course, we'll stay with our theme of Las Vegas. And I happen to have, I'm going to add from SharePoint. So this is going to add some pictures from my different libraries. So we'll go ahead and choose the Vegas library and pull in some pictures that I took at the last SPC. And now those are part of my photo story, but I'm going to add some from another library too. If you have some time, I recommend after the conference, the Valley of Fire is just gorgeous, wonderful hiking, all these nice red rocks, and it's only a few hours away. And on your way there, you might want to stop by Lake Mead, which was created as a byproduct of the Hoover Dam, and it's very pretty. So now I've got my story. You can see all the pictures are here. I've basically pulled in things from three different picture libraries into my story. And now I'll go back to the site. And notice that you didn't notice too much when I left the site because the branding was at least partly there. But this is the host web again. And I'll edit the page, and I'll add a web part, which will show my little story. So there it is. It's an app part. And it's going to come up and say, please edit this web part and tell me which photo story you want to show. So I'll do that. And it's a pretty familiar web part editing experience. And I'll show you how to set these up. And I'll type the name of the photo story. I'll leave it at the default of 3 seconds per photo. But I'll change the little transition effect. So I'm using the Nevo slider for my visuals. So you can, I just basically gave you all the choices that were available there. Thank you, Derek. I stole some of your code. And here is the here's the photo story kind of in a web part. So that's what it does. Now let's let me come over and flip Visual Studio over to this solution so that we can walk through the code. Okay, so the first thing I want to show is how this Chrome control works. So, by the way, you'll notice here, and I know it's a little bit hard to see because of this screen resolution, but I've got several projects here. I've got my database. I've got the database repository. So this is using something called the repository pattern, which is going to help us when we go to do unit testing. It's going to actually allow me to run my controller without any real data, but with artificial data that I'm going to inject into it for testing purposes. So I'm taking all of the Entity Framework stuff and putting it into this repository object or repository project. Here's my SharePoint project, the MVC project, and then here's a test project that we'll get to at the end. So let's just go right ahead into the MVC project. Here's my controller. And what I wanted to show you was the shared view now is going to contain the Chrome control. Now, the Chrome control is a little bit not too tricky to set up, but it's something that you want to look up and just follow the steps. And the nice thing is because you put it in your layout page, you really only have to do this once. So it's going to actually use the SharePoint object model, client object model, to pull the host URL, and it's going to run this little piece of JavaScript that's going to bring some branding information down into the SharePoint site and display it inside of this Chrome control container div. On the client side. You just pretty much follow the steps in the documentation to set this up. It's not a big deal. But that's one thing that That's how you basically bring the SharePoint branding in. Now, what's a little bit more interesting is when we start to talk to SharePoint. And so, again, this is designed maybe a little bit differently than you might be familiar, and it's for testability, which is the next demo after this. The SharePoint, I've implemented the SharePoint access logic. I could have just put it right in my controller. And in a simple example, maybe I would have just put it right in line in my controller. But instead, I made a set of helper classes that do different things to SharePoint. And then each one of these helper classes has an interface. And the rule is, when I'm talking to the Entity Framework repository or to SharePoint, I never talk to the objects themselves. I only talk to an interface. Why? Because when I go to test it, I'm going to put a fake version of that data repository and that SharePoint interface into place. And that way I can test it offline, and you can even set up Visual Studio to run the tests every single time you hit the build button. But of course that wouldn't work if you had to depend on all this data being there. So as a result, I end up with this whole little plethora of interfaces. I've got a number of helpers. You can download the code to dig into this. There's way more than we can go through during the session time. But the picture library helper is particularly interesting. This is where we actually go in and read from SharePoint. And so what we're going to do is there's this method called fill the add from SharePoint view model. Remember we were talking about view models? So let's take a little sidebar here and look at the view model as well. Here's the view. Actually, this is the add from SharePoint view. You saw me three times go in and pick photos out of those different photo libraries, and this is that view right here. So you can see that what it's doing is the model that it's binding to is this class called add from SharePoint VM or view model. So that's what it's going to bind to, and then all these little HTML dot things are actually binding to that. So I'm going to put hidden fields that contain the photo story ID and title so that when I post back, I know which photo story we were dealing with, right? And then here's the little drop-down list that lets me pick a picture library. And then here is the photos inside of a picture library. And you'll notice that I'm actually able to do an if statement and a for loop right inside of the view. So this is a whole lot easier, you'll find that, at least I find it's a whole lot easier than some of the repeater controls and templates and things that they had in web forms. It's much more intuitive, and yet two-way data binding still works. It's wonderful stuff. And so that's how all those thumbnails came along. So if you look at the view model is here, and it's just a C-sharp bunch of classes that are designed specifically for that view to bind to it. And when we get to testing, once again, this means that my automated tests can just look at the view model and see if the right answers are in there instead of trying to parse HTML on a web page, which is very hard. So here's my view model. Inside of here, I have a little picture view model for the little picture thumbnails that were coming down. And then I've got the things that are actually on the page. The ID, the title, which photo story is selected, and then this list of photo stories and all that kind of stuff. So if I go back to my SharePoint picture library helper, again, its job in life is to go to SharePoint and fill in that view model so that the view can render the pictures to the user. So the way this works is that I'm going to pull in the context, so pull in the current context from SharePoint. And then I'm going to go ahead and, assuming I get my context, I'm first going to fill in the list of picture libraries in that dropdown. And so I can do a nice little camel query. A nice little link query to go ahead and pull in all of the picture libraries. So the link query says, well, I want the client context.web.list, so if you've done server-side development, it's a lot like the server API. I've got the lists right here, where the list is not hidden, and where the base template was a picture library. So that's going to get me a list of picture libraries. Then I'm going to load that query, and the execute query will actually go out and get that data for me. Now, down here, I'm going to go and actually fill in the list of pictures for whatever the currently selected picture library is, and I'm going to come in and do the same kind of a link query to that to actually pull in the details of all these photos. Now, a little caveat right here. I was having this discussion with one of my colleagues yesterday. It would be nice if we could just leave Camel behind and completely use Link for all of this. But the reality, and here's actually a little, here's where I would put the Camel, but I'm just getting all items, and then I'm looping through them down here. The guidance on this is the way the client object model works. If I was to use Link to, in this example, I'm not worried about it because I'm getting all the pictures. But imagine I was just going to get the pictures of a certain resolution, or I was going to get the pictures that matched a certain query, or I was going to page through them. Right? I could use a link query to do that, but what would happen under the covers is that the client object model up on the server would ask SharePoint for all of the pictures, and then it would run link to objects to filter that down. And that would be really inefficient and might actually not work because it might exceed its limit of how much data it could handle. So the best practice, the strong best practice is to use Camel if you're querying a list or a library to filter it down. And then you can go ahead and use Link for other things. So that's how the SharePoint access works. And then where does that get called from? I might as well show you that quickly as well. So if I go back to my controller and go to the Add from SharePoint. So here I'm making sure I have a SharePoint context. And then I'm going to go ahead and do some error checking. And then if that all works and I've got a valid photo story and everything else looks good, then I'm going to go ahead and call and notice again that I've got an interface and not the actual, I'm not actually, don't have any hard-coded knowledge in here of the actual class that underlies that interface. That'll fill in the view model and then it passes that view model into the view, which we saw earlier was bound to the view model. And now you get the whole picture of how the data flows from SharePoint into the view model and onto the page. Make sense? So the last thing I want to show in terms of SharePoint integration is the web part. And the web part is up here, if I can find the right project. The web part is up here in the SharePoint project, and it's here in this little folder. And this is what the client web part looks like. So don't tell anybody, but the client web part is really just an iframe. It's really just an iframe. And so my actual web part is implemented as a page down in the MVC application. And I'll show you that right after this. But right in order to kind of expose that page on the screen, I wrote this little web part. And what it does is basically I just give it a title, a description, a default size. And then I tell it the URL of where that page is. Notice that a couple of things about the URL. It has these little tokens in it. So the standard tokens are the things that give you the SharePoint context. Underscore PS name, that's my photo story name. So I put that right on the URL because I can use the URL itself now. I don't have to put all that kind of custom stuff on the query string. That's going to get passed as an argument into my controller, so that I can show the correct photo story. And then the transition and the speed of the slideshow, those I'm passing in as a query string. And so I declare all this, and then I come down and tell and declare all the properties that I'm going to pass in. So here's the photo story name. It's a string. Basically give it all this information. And then SharePoint will generate that little panel where I was able to edit, the editing panel that I filled in, and will create the corresponding URL to my page. So that's how my settings get passed into the page. Notice here that all those different transitions are listed here as well. So it knew how to do that pull down. So if I come down to the controller again, there is an action method for the web part view. And that's actually going to go ahead and grab the photo stories or grab the correct photo story. And notice here that this, I can use Link to get the right photo story that I want to show. Entity Framework is going to handle that for me. It's actually going to generate an SQL query. So this is not like the Camel case, right? This is actually going to do a nicely optimized SQL query for me. A little caveat to notice here is that when I go to do my unit testing, I faked out the repository by writing a bunch of generic collections, generic lists. So when I run my unit tests, it will actually use link to objects. And when I run my integration tests, or when I actually run the website, it will be running link to entities as part of entity framework. So this is kind of a little caveat. There's no real way to avoid it, except to say that there's also importance to doing the integration tests, because sometimes link to objects and link to entities will behave a little bit differently. So then I'll go ahead and pass all that information into the view model for that for the slideshow. And then let me quickly show you the view. The view model isn't all that interesting. It's similar to the other one, but the view is kind of interesting because it actually is going to include the photos. Now the photos, I'm injecting the photos, the list of photos, into the view model, and I'm serializing them into JSON. So I'm not going to dig into the details of that code, but it's in the solution. It's not a heck of a lot of code. It's using something called the data contract JSON serializer. Say that one three times fast. And it is, and you can just download the code and see how that works. But it's taking the list of photos and making them into JSON so that on the client side, the script can pick them up and do the slideshow. Perhaps a cooler way of doing this would be to write a RESTful service that my client side could call. And if I was going to do that, I would use Web API, which is also an MVC technology that does web services. And so this talk is followed immediately. We planned it this way. Scott Hillier is going to, in this room at 10:45, kind of pick up where this talk leaves off and talk all about Web API. So I encourage you to stay for that talk. The other thing that's interesting about this is the script itself. So where's the script that runs on the client and actually renders the slideshow? A really cool thing that MVC does is that it actually bundles your scripts for you. So if I want to break up my scripts in a modular fashion and have lots of little scripts, that might not be very efficient because my browser is going to have to retrieve them all. And as it retrieves them, it only has so many threads, and it's going to only be able to read so many at a time. It'll slow down my page. So this bundler will actually build a big Uber script with a name by concatenating all my JavaScript together into this bundle, in this case, which I'm calling app. And it will even minify it for you so that you don't have to worry about that. So when you're debugging, you can use the full version. And then when you're at runtime, you'll get the minified version. So that's all configured here in this little bundle config. And you can see here that my bundle config, I've got the same thing for CSS, by the way. It'll bundle your CSS for you. Here's the CSS that the Nevo control needed. Here's the app bundle. So I'm saying I need jQuery, and then the Nevo slider, and then my little app. And then my little app.js is what actually does, kind of kicks off the process and points the Nevo slider at my list and tells it to go. So very cool way of managing scripts in MVC that wasn't available otherwise. So let's see. I think that's basically what I wanted. How are we doing on time? I think we should be just about on track. Good. So now the last thing I want to cover here, and leave a little bit of time for the drawing of the tablet computer and for some Q&A, last thing I want to discuss is testing. So testing may not seem like the most exciting thing, but I will tell you that it really does make a difference. And making your code testable can save a huge amount of time debugging the problems after the website is running. And I will tell you that in the course of building this demo, and I instrumented about a third of it, so I've got a lot more to do, and I'm hoping to update the code sample with a more comprehensive set of tests. I actually found bugs in my code as I was going. You can test exceptions and situations that you would have a tough time testing in a web browser. So it's really a great thing, and it can be completely automated. In order to make this work, there's three main concepts that you need to grasp. And the first one is called dependency injection, or inversion of control. And it's kind of a weird concept, but basically the idea of dependency injection is that if, rather than having the thing you want to test know where something is, you're going to tell it where that something is. So that you can later put in your little fake versions of those things. So here's a couple of examples, little code examples. If I, in the top one, I have a more traditional way of coding in which inside of my class, this might be the controller, I'm going to actually new up a database repository and then use it. Seems reasonable, but if I do that, how do I swap in a different database repository when it comes time to test? So instead, I just refactor it so that I have, I never talk to the DB repository class, I talk to an interface called IDB repository, and then I pass that in on the constructor. When my constructor runs, it saves away the database repository, and then I call it using the interface. That allows me in my test to just create the same class but pass in a different repository, different instance that implements the same method. The other two concepts that I'll show you in the demo, one of them is called Microsoft Fakes, and that does not mean that they just kind of did a vaporware product or something like that. Fakes is actually a very cool Visual Studio feature. It's available in the top two, so Ultimate and Premium, I think it is. And what that will do is it will generate stubs and shims. So a stub is basically a fake version of a class. It'll generate all the code for you so that you can fake out a repository. And then a shim is for something that already exists. So like if you're trying to simulate one of the system DLLs, you can't really fake the entire thing. So it'll put a little shim in the middle and allow you to instrument the code inside. If you design everything perfectly, you won't need shims. You'll just use stubs. You'll be able to just substitute. So the shim is there for instances where you can't do this pattern. And then the other thing that I'll show you is the Visual Studio Test Explorer, which is a really nice way to run these tests. So let's go back to demo. And we'll go into the view, and I'm sorry, go into test. And we'll see here that there's a window called the Test Explorer. And here are my tests. And as I say, I've got a ways to go. The ones that begin in INT are integration tests, and the ones that start with unit are unit tests. The only real difference is the integration tests use the real entity framework database. So they're not going to work if there's no database. And I also have to be aware that I'm not quite sure what's in that database when it runs, because I might change it. Whereas the unit tests are going to use a fake repository that I wrote. And I wrote it, as I mentioned, just using some simple objects. So remember how simple that original, well, you didn't, I guess you didn't see the model here. The model is similarly simple to my first example. It's just a few simple C# classes. So my fake repository just creates generic lists of those classes and puts some sample data in there so that I can inject that in and run the unit tests. And as I said, I can make little playlists, so I can have it run different sets of tests on commands. On command, I can also have it automatically run these every time I do a build. So let's look at the dependency injection for just a minute. There's this thing called a bootstrapper. So when my app runs, it does this little initialize, and there's a bunch of different what they call dependency injection frameworks or inversion of control frameworks out there. I'm using one called AutoFac, which is just one I kind of got started with through a friend. But Unity is a Microsoft one that you may have heard of. There's a bunch of them out there. it doesn't really matter. The point is that you add this in from NuGet, and then this basically allows MVC to know that you're going to pass in these interfaces into the controller and into its other objects. So it's going to go ahead and set up the dependencies to the PhotoStory repository, and that whole connection string stuff has moved into this Bootstrapper class now. So when I'm actually at runtime, it's going to set up a real repository with the correct connection string for runtime. And then here's my SharePoint factory helper. And you can see that I'm telling the dependency injection framework what interface to use and whether or not to create an instance per HTTP request, or there's all kinds of other ways that you can have it instantiate these objects for you. And then I register this with MVC using a dependency resolver so that when MVC calls my controller, if I go back to my controller all the way up to the top, it's actually going, you can see that it's actually going to pass in the repository and the SharePoint helper factory, and pass those right into the constructor so that all of my action methods are only depending on the interface. Okay? So that's the runtime case. Let's look at a unit test to see how this works from a testing point of view. So this is a unit test which I called Unit Details Handles Invalid Photo Story. So this is my photo story details page, and I'm imagining that somebody sent in an invalid photo story name. So this is a great example of something that you wouldn't normally do on a website. Like if I had a QA team, and I said, I want you to, you know, use your web browser and pound away at this site, my site would hopefully not generate a link to an invalid photo story. So they would not test this case, right? Later, somebody with a favorite in their web browser might go back to that favorite, and it might point to a photo story that's not there anymore, and all of a sudden they might, for the very first time, be testing my exception handling logic of a bad photo story. So I want to test it automatically and make sure that as people are working with my code, they don't accidentally forget that it's possible that somebody would pass in a bad photo story. So this unit test does exactly that. And the way it works is the pattern of unit tests is called arrange, act, assert. So the very first thing I do is arrange. I set up the stage, sort of. This is Las Vegas, so it's perfect. Imagine that we're going to a show and we're setting the stage. And what we're going to do is make a test photo repository. And then I'm going to go ahead and get a controller. And if I go to this, you can see the fakes at work. So this, since all my tests needed a controller created the same way, I basically put them in a separate class. But you'll see here that it's actually going to create my SharePoint helper object using fakes. So fakes is really cool. All you have to do is go into your references, right-click on anything, and add a fakes assembly. And Visual Studio will generate that fakes assembly for you. And then when you declare it, you can override any of the methods and properties that you don't want it to just, like, by default, it doesn't really do anything. So my unit test only needs one method, which is give me the current person ID. So I'm just going to return the current person ID, which I think is set to a hard-coded number of 1 by my code. So it allows me to just go in and override the parts that I'm going to use, that I'm going to exercise in my test. So now if I come back to my little unit test, I've set up the test photo story and the test repository. Now I'm going to go ahead and act. I'm going to call my controller, the details method. And oh, I'm in the null one. Sorry, handles invalid. So I'm going to pass in a photo story that, that's the valid one. I'll eventually get to the invalid one. Okay, inside of my little fake repository that I wrote, I actually put some constants like invalid photo story ID. So I know what data is in there because I just created it all in code. So I was able to make an invalid one that I guarantee my code did not use. And that's a good way of exercising this exception path. So I'm going to go ahead and call the details method. It's the actual real code in my controller with all the stuff around it now arranged to be simulated. I'm going to pass in an invalid story. And what I should get back is a 404 status code. And so I can now check my action result and make sure that this is an action result of that it's not null. And then what it's doing is returning the status code of 404. And now every time I do my build, I make sure that it's checking that and returning the correct status code instead of, say, giving some funny error message or blowing up with a stack trace in my user's face and showing them something that they shouldn't see. So really great technology, and I encourage you to look into it. So here are a few things that I didn't really have time for, but I encourage you to look into. Entity Framework does data validation using just little annotations. So actually, Visual Studio generated a little bit of this for us. You can decorate your model class with information about the data validation, and it will take care of that for you. Deployment to the App Catalog and Office Store is really straightforward. Basically, you upload it to your Enterprise App Catalog. That's something else to look at. DB scripting I mentioned earlier. And the web API, again, is the next session. So my call to action is to use these cloud-hosted apps to move to the latest and greatest version of web development, to improve your SharePoint stability by running the code outside of SharePoint, and to create solutions that work both on-premises and in the cloud. MVC is great for testability, extensibility, and flexibility, and Entity Framework can greatly simplify your access to relational data. Here are some other sessions that I thought you might find interesting. So Web API I mentioned, highly scalable SharePoint 2013 apps is this afternoon, which will tell you about how to do this at high scale and build on the same thing. The SharePoint Office app security model is actually happening tomorrow morning. That's Ted Pattison's talk on OAuth. And then the development patterns for SharePoint apps, I thought that would also be interesting, is going to get more into patterns and practices around all of this. So here's some resources. I'll leave this up, and I thank you all for coming. Let's go ahead and do the drawing. So. All right, so I'm going to try to pick a name that I can pronounce so I don't completely embarrass myself. Lawrence Smithmeyer.
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Congratulations. So this is a nice Dell Venue Pro. Love this device. So thank you all for coming. Please remember to fill in an evaluation. Check out the code, a bunch of other links here that I think you'll find interesting. If you liked the session, please give me a great eval. If you didn't like the session, please enjoy the rest of your day and the rest of your visit here in Las Vegas. Thank you.